The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Now, welcome to The Heretics Hour of the 20th of May, 2013. I am not Carolyn Yeager, I am Hadding Scott. Tonight, I will be discussing George Lincoln Rockwell, a seminal figure in the history of the white resistance in the United States. Rockwell, of course, is best known for being the first American, at least in the post-war period, after the Second World War, to proclaim himself openly as a National Socialist, defying all the propaganda of demonization that had so heavily impressed the perception in American minds of Adolf Hitler and National Socialism. George Lincoln Rockwell's conversion to National Socialism was the result of a chain of realizations that began in 1951 when he was a naval flight instructor in San Diego. And somebody gave him the first anti-Jewish literature that he had ever seen, an issue of Conde McGinley's Common Sense, which was a newspaper. This is Rockwell narrating what happened. The story was all about a Jewish world plot, and I couldn't finish reading it. It seemed too silly and disgusting for an intelligent man to waste his time on. But in the few lines I did read, Common Sense gave what it claimed were startling facts about the Jewishness of communism and the Russian Revolution. It listed as the sources of some of these unbelievable facts the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia and various official U.S. government documents. This seemed like an excellent opportunity to spike such a fantastic idea as that of communism being Jewish, and I decided to check out these supposed facts. I went over to the San Diego Public Library in Balboa Park and dug around in the volumes mentioned in Common Sense. Down there in the dark stacks of the library, I got my awakening from 30 years of stupid political sleep, the same deadly sleep now closing the eyes of our people and making them cooperate with their enemies in their own destruction, all in the name of good citizenship, brotherhood, and all the rest of the shibboleths of nice people. I found that communism was not only Jewish, but the Jews boasted about its Jewishness in their own books and papers. Now, I'm going to say that while it is completely gratifying and desirable that Rockwell was inspired to check the information that he read, because as somebody who writes about these kinds of things, I always include sources. And I want people, if they have any doubts about what I'm saying, to check my sources. Check the sources that I used and make sure that what I'm saying is true. Unfortunately, some of the sources that Rockwell checked when he was trying to verify what Conde McGinley's newspaper said, some of those sources themselves were not very good. The Jewishness of Bolshevism, the Jewish domination of Bolshevism before 1920, at least, is a fact. But a lot of the sources that were used as testimony to that effect were not very good. A lot of secondhand information giving names and numbers about how many Jews were in which bodies of Bolshevik legislators, etc. A lot of that secondhand information was not reliable at all. On my blog, I have a post about the members of the Bolshevik Central Committee in October 1917, and 8 out of 12 of them were Jews. but a lot of the other information that has been circulated, some of which fooled Condé McGinley and then Rockwell, a lot of the other information is not so accurate. After Rockwell found out that Jews in general tended to be communists or Zionists, or more generally speaking, just weren't loyal to the nation among whom they lived, and that Jews were involved in the promotion of race mixing, which was certainly a big issue in the 1950s, Rockwell realized that this cast Adolf Hitler in a different light. It meant that what Adolf Hitler had said about Jews was correct. So Rockwell wondered, what else did Hitler have right? Rockwell acquired a copy of Mein Kampf and he began to read it. Rockwell says, and that was the end of Lincoln Rockwell as the nice guy, the dumb goy, and the beginning of an entirely different person. Rockwell continues, Mein Kampf was like finding part of me. Chaos and disorder and mental grayness are immensely frustrating to me, and I had suffered for years trying to fathom the bottomless philosophical, social, and political mess in the world, and the even messier explanations offered by religions and sociology. Over and over I had said to myself, there must be some sense, some logical causal relationship between social and political facts as to how they got that way. But no person, no book, nor my own mind had been able to discover head or tail to these things. I simply suffered from the vague, unhappy feeling that things were wrong, without knowing exactly how, and that there must be a way of diagnosing the disease and its causes, and making intelligent, organized efforts to correct that something wrong. In Mein Kampf, I found abundant mental sunshine, which bathed all the gray world suddenly in the clear light of reason and understanding. Word after word, sentence after sentence, stabbed into the darkness like lightning bolts of revelation, tearing and ripping away the cobwebs of more than 30 years of darkness, brilliantly illuminating the heretofore obscure reasons for the world's madness. I was transfixed, hypnotized. I could not lay the book down without agonies of impatience to get back to it. I read it walking to the squadron. I took it into the air and read it, propped up on the chart board while I automatically gave the instructions to the other planes circling over the desert. I read it on the Coronado ferry. I read it into the night and resumed the next morning. When I had finished, I started again and reread every word, underlining and marking especially magnificent passages. I studied it, thought about it, and wondered at the utter, indescribable genius of it. How could the world not only ignore such a book, but damn it, and curse it, and hate it, and pretend that it was a plan for conquering the world, when it was the most obvious and rational plan for saving the world which has ever been written? Had nobody read it, I wondered, that people now went around saying that it was the work of a mad rug chewer? Of course, that's a rumor that was put out by William Shirer, based on a misunderstanding of a German expression. Chewing the carpet means that somebody was very angry. German slang expression. How could sensible people get away with such monstrous intellectual fraud? Why was it so hated and cursed? I could see why the Jews would hate and curse it, but why my own people? I reread and studied it some more. Slowly, bit by bit, I began to understand. I realized that National Socialism, the iconoclastic worldview of Adolf Hitler, was the doctrine of scientific racial idealism, actually a new religion for our times. I saw that I was living in the age of a new worldview. 2,000 years ago, there had been a similar rise of a new approach or worldview called a religion, a worldview which shook and changed the world forever. I realized that this new and wonderful doctrine of scientific truth applied ruthlessly to man himself, as well as to nature and inanimate matter, and that it was the only thing which could save man from his own degradation in luxury, self-seeking short-sightedness, and racial degeneration. The doctrine of Adolf Hitler was the new Christianity of our times, and Adolf Hitler himself was the new savior sent by inscrutable providence recurrently to rescue a collapsing humanity. Hitler's and Germany's crucifixion was all according to the inevitable workings of this unknowable scenarist. That idea that a God-man is sent periodically actually, I believe, comes from Hinduism. This next sentence is a little bit extravagant. Even the 11 hanged disciples in Nuremberg were not without significance. He's referring to the executions following the International Military Tribunal in 1946-47. The most hated and dreaded idea 2,000 years ago was Christianity, and the most hated and cursed man on earth was Jesus Christ. His followers were bitterly persecuted and murdered by the good, sensible people who could see that anybody in his right mind recognized Rome and the Empire as the solid, substantial reality. I realized that today's Marxist democratic world is another sprawling Roman Empire, and today's Nazis the early Christians. What is going on is far more than a battle for political supremacy in the present social and political situation. It is the utter smashing and destruction of a society which has become so rotten that it will tolerate and even love its own Marxist destroyers, just as it hates, despises, and fears the slowly growing Nazi society which will replace it. Such mighty, awesome thoughts come to a man but once in a lifetime, if ever, and when they do, that man changes for all time. At once a great weight lifted off my soul. I knew that I had found my way to the sun at last, and the days of mental darkness, searching, and endless frustration were over. But at the same time, an immensely heavy burden replaced it, but in a different, even satisfying way. I knew that I had to, I must do what I could to spread the new and wonderful idea and secure its victory in the collapsing world, no matter what it cost me, or even if I were to become a failure to be fed to the lions in the Colosseum. Now, Rockwell was expressing the understandable exuberance of somebody that has suddenly become clear about his purpose in life. He was animated with his new sense of purpose. The proposition that Christianity was reaching its end and would need to be replaced with a new worldview derives from Friedrich Nietzsche. Rockwell had studied philosophy at Brown University for his 2 years there. Rockwell confirms the influence of Nietzsche after that little narrative that I just read by declaring, "We are the new barbarians forged to iron hardness in the fires of their hate and persecution." This term, new barbarians, is straight out of Nietzsche. The identification of the American-dominated world order, which had replaced the British Empire as the dominant force in the world after the Second World War, the identification of that with Rome makes perfect sense when you consider that Rockwell had read Brooks Adams' book, The Law of Civilization and Decay, which explicitly compares Great Britain at the end of the 19th century to the Roman Empire in its stages of decay. The United States is simply continuing, taking over the role of Great Britain and continuing the decay. Brooks Adams explains that the reason why the Roman Empire and now the English-speaking world are following this course, this decay into miscegenation and collapse, it's all because of usury. And the Jews are the kings of usury. They're the kings of economic society, economically oriented society, as opposed to spiritually oriented society. And Adolf Hitler in the Table Talk also compares Jesus in a way to National Socialism by saying that, that Jesus was opposing the materialism of his day. So what Rockwell is saying here is not without foundation. His comparison is not completely absurd. It was in the early stages of Rockwell's awakening that he wrote a poem that you may have seen called The Fable of the Ducks and the Hens. If you haven't read that, I suggest you look it up. Well, what else did Rockwell do? I decided to go directly into politics, provided I could somehow find a way to earn two livings at the same time. By this time, I had had plenty of opportunity to look over the activity of the right wing, the conservatives, and had come to the conclusion, in my total ignorance of the real nature of the case, that all they needed to succeed was an organizational drive to get them together with a businesslike plan. I had found that there were dozens and maybe hundreds of very rich men like H.L. Hunt of Texas and Robert Welch of Boston who felt much as I did and who, together, could pool enough money and resources to swamp the Marxist Zionist Jews and left-wingers. There seemed to be plenty of talent and ability, and an actual majority of our people over on my side of politics, so that common sense seemed to force the conclusion that it was only a lack of determined effort to put this together which permitted the left-wing minority, sparked by the sub-minority of Jews, to keep winning victory after victory, and thereby send America down the path to Marxist socialism and racial disintegration. The conservatives, as I saw the problem, lacked any real national and popular medium of expression. I carefully planned a national newspaper to be called The Conservative Times, and still think it would be successful if the people on the right, who are still nice, unlike me, would finance it. I learned from surveys that in Washington alone, the market for such a newspaper, where the only voices heard are stridently liberal, was large enough to support it. Many people in the area would have paid then and would still pay now a premium price for a real right-wing paper, even if advertisers were hard to get. And with a newspaper, it would be easy to organize and even discipline the splintered and squabbling right wing into a cohesive, effective organization. I realized even then that talking and educating are silly and useless unless they are directed at the only worthwhile political goal, power. The newspaper must first give our side a voice, then help it organize by effective communication, then discipline it by withholding or granting recognition and praise, as is necessary to produce a sense of responsibility and direction in the movement, as the Jews now do with our entire machinery of communication and entertainment. When any public figure goes the way the Jews wish him to go, he is lavishly praised and built up in the press. And when he displeases them, he is greeted by dead silence. No matter how newsworthy his statement or action, or he is smeared and blasted until he slinks away with his tail between his legs. With a newspaper, we could gradually begin to do the same thing on our side, and I set about the task of applying my ability and experience toward the development of such a newspaper, and eventually a strong conservative organization aimed at political power. Now, Rockwell was certainly on the right track with his initial impulse after his political awakening, based on the recognition that the foundation of his movement must be the establishment of white media. The goal of uniting the right wing, however, or even getting the cooperation of any significant number of right wingers, proved to be very difficult, Rockwell says. I reckoned without any knowledge of the human content of the right wing, from the millionaires to the scared little people who attend the endless, pitiful, conservative, 100% American, old-fashioned, constitutional, states' rights meetings. I learned by bitter experience that the human material of the right wing consists 90% of cowards, dopes, nuts, one-track minds, blabbermouths, boobs, incurable tightwads, and, worst of all, hobbyists. People who have come to enjoy a perverted, masochistic pleasure in telling each other forever how we are all being raped by the you-know-whos, but who under no condition would risk their two cars, landscaped homes, or juicy jobs to do something about it. Knowing nothing of this, however, and being full of my usual enthusiasm and drive, I paid for a series of radio spots before and after Fulton Lewis's show, announcing a Washington meeting to organize the right wing. Fulton Lewis was a former newspaper columnist who had supported the America First Committee, and at the time of Rockwell's political awakening, was supporting Senator Joseph McCarthy. His radio show was based in Washington, D.C., where Rockwell hoped to establish his newspaper, and was carried on the Mutual Radio Network. Politically, Fulton Lewis was about as far right as mass media could get at the time, which is very, very right-wing by today's standards. Later on, with the decline of conservatism, Fulton Lewis declined with it and supported Barry Goldwater. It is understandable that in 1951, George Lincoln Rockwell regarded an advertisement during Fulton Lewis's radio show as an excellent place to begin to organize the right wing. Rockwell continues, "The response seemed to be gratifying. Hundreds of people called, and I arranged with one of them, Sam Jones, the correspondent of Bill Buckley's National Review, to use his lovely old Virginia mansion in McLean for our first meeting. Of the hundreds who called, only about 50 showed up at the meeting, including John Casper and an Arab friend. I addressed the meeting in the best conservative style, lecturing nicely on the need to get together more than anything else, during which I received little flurries of polite applause. How I shudder now to think of all that feeble, useless, stupid niceness, while our race and our whole world are being brutally destroyed. From time to time, somebody in the audience would ask, 'What about the Jews?' And there would be snickers and shifting around of feet like grammar school kids when somebody mentions the word sex. Then I would scold this bold character for such a disgusting display of prejudice, making my righteous love of the wonderful Jews very clear, and even sharing knowing winks with some of the close friends there in mutual appreciation of my clever deception. The Jews would not have disturbed such a meeting for anything in the world. We, like a million other conservatives, were indulging ourselves in the illusion of fighting treason, subversion, communism, and race mixing. In other words, the Jews, without doing anything and without hurting the enemy himself. If we did not have such silly little secret meetings, we would eventually build up such a pressure of frustrated patriotism that we just might have done something forceful and therefore effective. My wife took up a little collection, we passed out membership cards, and then stood around babbling, as is the inevitable custom after such battles with the enemy. Everybody congratulated everybody else at this new and terrible assault on the Eskimos, as John Casper called them at the time, and we went home all aglow with the great success. I poured out my time and money in an all-out effort to organize the right wing nicely, under the aegis of the American Federation of Conservative Organizations, and published a national conservative newspaper. We held meetings in the best meeting rooms in the Statler and Mayflower hotels. I had beautiful stationery engraved in gold. I used all my skill in art, writing, organizing, promoting, and leading, the same skills which are now serving the American Nazi Party so well. But my best efforts were useless. The basic premise of conservatism was wrong. Now, what Rockwell says next strikes me as problematic. The interpretation is something that one has to do carefully. Although it is made to appear so, the battle between the conservatives and liberals is not a battle of ideas or even of political organizations. It is a battle of force, terror, and power. The Jews and their accomplices and dupes are not running our country and its people because of the excellence of their ideas or the merit of their work or because they have the genuine backing of the majority. The Zionists are in power in spite of the lack of these things, and only because they have driven their way into power by daring minority tactics. They can stay in power only because people are afraid to oppose them, afraid they will be socially ostracized, afraid they will be smeared in the press, afraid they will lose their jobs, afraid they will not be able to run their businesses, afraid they will lose their political offices. It is fear, and fear alone, which keeps these filthy left-wing sneaks in power. It is not ignorance on the part of the American people, as the conservatives keep assuring each other. Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. When the truth is that any slave knows the truth, that he is a slave. But he is not free in spite of knowing this truth unless he can somehow obtain the power to force his way to freedom. It is not the truth which will make us free in America, because millions already know the truth and hate bitterly what is going on. But they are afraid even to admit that they know the truth. 10 million signed the petition for Joe McCarthy, and they are not all dead. Although they might as well be, as long as the right wing spends all its time and money trying to win another 10 million, instead of getting the 10 million we already have to stand up. We have plenty of people, money and facilities to take America back from the traitors tomorrow morning if all the people who already know what is going on were not afraid anymore and would stand up. What Rockwell seems to be getting at is that the people who know the truth must gain the ability to plan and act based on that truth. To do that, they have to be able to discuss the truth as they know it. Rockwell does not discount the importance of effective arguments. He is saying that courage is also required. Employing really effective arguments certainly requires courage, because effective arguments are the ones that will be strenuously opposed and denounced. Making those effective arguments, cutting the Gordian knot by discussing racial inequality and the role of the Jews, and above all advocating National Socialism, means not being nice. If you really get at the core of the problem, you have to cross those boundaries of so-called responsible conservatism. You have to stop being nice, as the Jews would define it for us. As long as the right wing confines its fighting to being nice, the great masses of the public will bow down like the sheep they are to the left wing, which is not nice, which uses smear, economic persecution, legal harassment, and finally, physical terror to maintain its domination of our national life and culture by force. The force is disguised, of course, in checkbooks, judges' robes, rigged party conventions, etc., but it is still force, or the threat of it, which has America down and afraid. No amount of papers and pamphlets, were they all masterpieces of propaganda, and no amount of talk and meetings can stop this growing left-wing force and power, and the fear it inspires, much less drive it back and destroy it. But in 1955, I still imagined that we could sneak up on the Jews, like my sissy friends. We would build a great grassroots membership by not mentioning the Jews at all, or even praising them. Then, while the Jews suspected nothing, we could become stronger and stronger. And finally, one day, we would wipe the smiles off our faces, spin around on the surprised Hebrews, and let them see just what we had in mind. I found this coward's dream being promoted everywhere I went. Every conservative I met would draw me aside and groan about the latest outrages and treason of the you-know-whos, and describe to me the latest plans to sneak up on the tormentors. I was as much beguiled by this childish illusion as anybody else. I spent hundreds of hours discussing the methods for this super-sneaky revolution, and the only thing I gained from it all was the final discovery that it was and always has been impossible to unseat the terrorists by talk. One must dislodge such evil usurpers by the same weapon which got them in, power. Theirs was and is secret and disguised. Ours, by nature, must be open, legal, and honest, but it must still be power, not talk or pamphlets or sneaky dreams. Thus, it involves risk. All of Rockwell's statements about the necessity of power and force have to be viewed in terms of his policy of strict legality. It turns out that Rockwell meant, by gaining power, that he intended to run for political office. Okay, tonight we are discussing George Lincoln Rockwell, relying especially on passages from his 1960 book, This Time the World. George Lincoln Rockwell openly proclaimed himself as a Nazi for the first time in 1958. I was determined, of course, to set up a program which was essentially National Socialist, Nazi, but for a long time I toyed with the idea of disguising it, as do most other right-wingers, by using some other name and a slightly different symbol. At that time, an openly Nazi party seemed too fantastic even to think about. But then I began to reflect that the ultimate smear of the Jews was always, "You're a Nazi," and I wondered what it would be like to answer, "You're damned right we're Nazis, and we shall shortly stuff you Jew traitors into the gas chamber." At once I had the answer. By being an open, arrogant, all-out Nazi, not a sneaky Nazi, but a Nazi with the swastika, stormtroopers, and open declarations of our intentions to gas the Jew traitors, after investigations, trials, and convictions, I would not only make an end of the filthy, silent treatment, for they could never ignore Nazis with swastika armbands and talk of gas chambers, but I would also force the Jews to publish my propaganda in their press. Every time they would howl that I advocated gas chambers, people would be shocked, but they would also lose a tiny bit of their fear of the Jews, as the Bible calls the filthy terror inspired by these apostles of tolerance. If millions of people kept reading in the Jew press about a man who was not only an anti-Semite, but an open Hitlerite, a Nazi, and survived as such, the myth of Jewish invincibility would be smashed. Actually, this is a valid observation. If you can go to a college campus, if you're a student at a university, and you say some things that are beyond the pale of what's considered progressive and enlightened. If you say those things that people are afraid to say, and you don't get destroyed, if you're careful enough in your behavior that you don't give a pretext for the powers that be to destroy you, and you survive actually using your freedom of speech, you will change people's opinions and perceptions. Back to Rockwell. The timid little people all over the country who have been silently and fearfully reading all this material designed to wake them up all these years would begin to creep out of their closets. While the Jews were desperately busy combating me, the little fellows would become bolder and would begin to act more like their American forefathers. This also happened with Henry Ford and his International Jew. So he says, by being a Nazi with the swastika, I would also gather the only kind of people I wanted around me, the tough, dedicated idealists ready to fight for those ideals and give their lives if necessary. And even more important, I would automatically scare off the millions of blabbermouths, cowards, fools, and crackpots which infest the rest of the movement. The swastika would probably not bring me many supporters, but those who came would be men. Of course, William Pierce had some criticisms of what kinds of people Rockwell actually did attract. It was not what Rockwell anticipated. The swastika would bring me still another bonus. For years, the American judicial system, including the Supreme Court, has been pushed, shoved, and twisted for the benefit of the Jew communist subversives and traitors. One decision after another has been rendered, making it safer to preach treason and subversion. The American Civil Liberties Union has worked tirelessly and effectively to break down the resistance of our government and officials against the inroads of communist arrogance, while the public has been taught to turn the other cheek and be so tolerant that the vilest traitors must be accorded every right, including the right of spitting in the eye of Congress with their Fifth Amendment impudence, referring there to investigations of communists. Thanks to the efforts of the Jews themselves, it is impossible simply to grab Nazis and throw them into jail without some kind of proceedings. Otherwise, they would expose their tyranny for all to see. The self-same court rulings which enable the Jew communists to drive their daggers closer to the beating heart of America enable us to preach and to organize the gassing of the traitors according to law. Freedom of speech for Jew communist traitors means freedom of speech for Nazis.
Now, I'm here tonight to tell you that there is no compromise whatsoever with the truth. We are the only weapon that we have in the right wing, in pro-American, pro-white Christian American Republicanism, or whatever you want to call it. There is no compromise with the truth. That's the only weapon we have. And when we compromise the truth and try to sneak, we are competing with the biggest sneaks in the world. And if there's anybody in this room that thinks for 1 minute that we can out-sneak the Jews, he's got another thing coming. They are the master sneaks of all times. We are not sneaks. Our kind of people are direct. Our Anglo-Saxon and Germanic and Nordic forefathers stand up with mighty club if they had to, and they stand up to their enemies and they beat them over the head until they win or they get beaten. They don't go sneaking and skulking around like a bunch of Jews. They don't use lies. The only way we can win is to stand up like men and fight. Now, I believe that we have lost for all these years, not only in America, but all over the world, because we have continually been sucked into this business of believing there's some easy way to win. Everybody has tried to do it by telling a little bit of the truth. And folks, this is like being a little bit pregnant. It just isn't possible. You either tell the truth or you are a liar. You've got to stand up for the whole truth.
So, in one respect, Rockwell's innovation of dressing up in a brown shirt uniform, which was the most taboo thing that anybody could do while trying to engage in politics, it represented a way of, well, it was a deliberate smashing of a taboo. It was a way to stop people from being afraid anymore by doing the most taboo thing that could be done. To take that weapon of fear away from the Jews by violating it, by trampling it. Unfortunately, this gets muddled with the idea of attracting media attention. On the one hand, Rockwell was trying to set an example of courage that would get other people not to be afraid to speak out. On another hand, he was doing theatrics to get the mass media, the Jewish-controlled mass media, to give him publicity, which meant that he didn't come across usually the way he would have liked. He was portrayed as half crazy or completely crazy. And that was mixed at the same time with the motive of, as he said in that little sound clip there, trying to tell the truth, trying to get the truth across. So you've got three different motives there at the same time, not really working together harmoniously. The first two, the bit about breaking down the barrier of fear and being seen as crazy, might coexist to some extent. But nobody wants to be seen as crazy. And if you're trying to get truth across, it's very hard when people think you're crazy. So there really was a confusion of purposes there in that uniformed activism. Rockwell had a four-stage plan for achieving power. He believed, like Adolf Hitler in Germany, that he could achieve power in 14 years. Adolf Hitler joined the National Socialist German Workers' Party in 1919 and became chancellor in 1933. Rockwell declared himself a Nazi in 1958 and expected to be elected president in 1972, president of the United States, 14 years after he declared himself a National Socialist.
4 years ago, we began this party to do these things, to build up this army of fanatics. And my first aim, tactically, was to become known. And for that purpose, I resorted to almost anything legal. I drew the line at almost nothing. I risked my life time after time in order to force the paper curtain, as we call it, to break apart what they call a quarantine treatment. Many of you probably don't know this, but my opponents, those of the people that oppose me, are very proud of what they call a quarantine treatment. They say Rockwell is a disease, and we must confine him by not saying anything about him in the papers, nothing on the TV. We must never let anybody hear anything about this, or it'll spread. Of course, that in itself gives the thing away. They call it the quarantine treatment, because why would anything vile spread? Are you so stupid that you can't see whether it's vile or not? So I had to break this. I had to figure out some way of forcing the TV and the radio and all these other great media of public information. I had to force them to mention us over and over and over and over again, and I've done it. We're known all over this earth, behind the Iron Curtain, everywhere. I've got friends in these places, and they tell me that they talk about us all the time in Hungary. In these places, it's a big subject of conversation. We have succeeded with phase one. Phase two is just what I'm doing here, to disabuse people of the screwy ideas they've got of us and try to show them what it is we really believe and give them a chance to judge it and think about it. That's phase two. It'll take about 6 years for that and overlaps a little bit in the first 4 years. The third phase is to take the people that have been converted by our propaganda, and some of you are sitting here right now who will be converted, to take you and organize you into a political machine. Now, you can't do it by just being on my side. Time after time, history has showed that you cannot win a political battle just because you're right or you've got the majority. You've got to have a machine. And we will, in phase three, build that political machine capable of winning electoral victory in our election. Phase four is doing just exactly that, running for president, running for every office we can, and being elected by our fair and square open processes. When we are elected to power, which we think we can do by 1972, and I might point out, we're a year ahead of schedule right now on the things that I've set forth on paper 4 years ago. We have accomplished. 4 years ago, ladies and gentlemen, I started out all alone, being kicked out of my house. I had to send my wife and kids away to Iceland. I had no money. I was just one man, all alone. And everybody ran away from me when I hung up the swastika. And now I've got men all over the country, all over the world, and we're growing very rapidly, considering the fact that I demand only the most elite people in this organization. We don't tolerate any people who are just hangers-on and thrill-seekers or hoodlums. We are growing, and we will continue to grow. And in 1972, we will be elected to national power. And as we've got written in our program, everything is written right down, there's nothing sneaky about it, we will hold a constitutional convention, and we will clean up the mess that's going on in Washington, the queers that I told you about, the lobbyists, the selfish people, the whole mess up there is going to be cleaned up legally. And America will once again be a free, decent, moral land for the people who build it, the white Christian Americans, the citizens of this great republic.
Okay, to summarize, there was a four-stage plan, four-phase plan. Stage one was to get publicity by any means necessary, which was combined with the purpose of allaying fear by setting an example of courage, by dressing up in a brown shirt uniform and doing public demonstrations. Phase two was the phase of educating the people whom Rockwell had thus reached, straightening out their understanding of what Rockwell really wanted to do. Phase three, organize those people. Phase four, seek political office. Now, the problem is that phase one and phase two are largely at cross purposes. Rockwell was engaging in provocative antics that tended to cause him to be misunderstood. In fact, sometimes he seemed to cultivate misunderstanding. The brown shirt uniforms were a deliberate provocation. He titled his first book, This Time the World, which is a reference to Second World War propaganda, which claimed that a song sung by the Hitler Youth, which says that tomorrow the whole world will hear us, actually says that tomorrow the whole world will belong to us. The song, his book was a reference to that distorted representation of World War II propaganda. So he was sort of exploiting World War II propaganda as a gimmick to attract attention to himself. Jewish mass media created the bogeyman, and Rockwell was there to say, yes, I am that bogeyman. Here I am. And he definitely succeeded in drawing attention to himself. But once he had gotten classified that way in the public mind, it was very hard to get serious people to support him. From the accounts that I've read, mostly the kinds of people that Rockwell attracted were hellraisers. He attracted hellraisers, people that enjoyed fighting and just stirring things up. What could he possibly do after that to build an effective organization with such people? All of that uniformed street activism for which Rockwell is known, and all the risk that was involved, it all belonged to stage one of his plan, of his four-phase plan. He really never got out of phase one. And the people who try to imitate Rockwell by dressing up in uniforms are really only imitating phase one of his four-phase plan, which in retrospect was a mistake. The idea, the basic idea of National Socialism was right. Rockwell actually apparently did understand National Socialism. In this speech from 1965, he tells a relatively affluent audience the importance of class reconciliation.
You have got to win your people back. And you're not going to win your people back by preaching the truth is going to make them free. You've got to win their heart. And to win their heart, you've got to have a heart. Now, this is the hardest thing for me to preach, especially in a gathering like this. It's not so difficult when you're out in the street talking to a bunch of truck drivers, but it's terribly hard to make people in the upper income levels understand that you have got to love the common man. Especially because that word is so filthy. It's used by every rotten politician in the country. They talk about the common man all the time until it makes you sick. But I do love the common man because the common man is our people. And he's been stolen away from you. Do you realize what they've done with this management versus labor business? They put the businessman over on one side and got all the businessmen hating labor because labor is now run by gangsters. And they've got the labor people all hating the businessmen as a bunch of dirty exploiters. Do you realize what they've done? This is they have taken the brains and the leadership away from the white race and dumped it in one corner. And they've got all the fists of the white race and the guts of the white race and put it in another corner and got them hating each other. And we've got to cut it out. You cannot fight labor. You cannot be only for your side and for your class. We've got to get rid of class. We've got to get rid of these divisions among us.
I argued in an essay following the 2012 presidential election that the reason why the Republicans did not even get as much of the white vote as they could have gotten was precisely because of their plutocratic economic policies. This less government ideology that the Republicans have adopted in place of any kind of real conservatism that would actually conserve a particular group of people, the white people in North America, this plutocratic ideology, this less government ideology, is a loser. It is self-destructive. It is, furthermore, When a party that advocates this ideology gets into power, what are they going to do? They're going to disarm themselves by reducing the power of their own government once they control it. Rockwell understood that mistake.
I am out to do one thing, and that is to get power. Too many people in the right wing are ashamed to say that. They're afraid to talk about power. They talk about getting rid of big government. Folks, it is not big government we should be afraid of. It's bad government. It's evil men in government. And you don't get rid of these people by, it's just like a town that's having trouble with gangsters. Can you imagine a town that's being overrun by gangsterism, disbanding the police department, decentralizing the police department and disarming them? What we need is tough guys, strong government, in order to get the rascals out.
George Lincoln Rockwell had already observed the mistake of Mitt Romney 2012 in the form of Barry Goldwater 1964. Exactly the same mistakes.
You've got to get together. And the minute you convince those people you're only interested in money and getting your taxes down and ideas that keep you in your social level of hell with them, you'll lose them. And that's what Goldwater did. Do you have any idea how many people in unions? I've done a lot of surveys. And every union in the country, there were thousands and thousands of people who hated the niggers, and they would have liked to vote for Goldwater because they thought he was against the niggers, but they were scared to death that Goldwater was going to take away their social security, their jobs, their unions, and destroy their economic security. That's why I lost. I want that the full import to sink into your heart, because this is why we keep losing.
Im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten, und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätter und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn, was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die, heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon stark. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon stark. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt. Was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit und welche Erbärmlichkeit.
Hello, this is Hadding Scott, second hour on the Heretics Hour. I have a blog that you might want to check out. It's national-socialist-worldview.blogspot.com. If you heard a little snippet of music at the end of the first hour, that's from a song about George Lincoln Rockwell that was written and recorded by a progressive rock band called Dresden that put out a cassette, I think, and probably a CD also with Resistance Records. We have all the tracks on one of my other blogs, which is williamlutherpierce.blogspot.com. In this hour, I'm going to start out by talking about Rockwell's idea of propaganda. George Lincoln Rockwell presented his ideas about propaganda in the essay From Ivory Tower to Privy Wall, which appeared in the first issue of National Socialist World in 1966. It was a periodical compiled and edited by Dr. William Pierce, who had met Rockwell 2 years earlier. And it was designed to appeal to intellectuals. National Socialist World was targeted at intellectuals. In his essay, Rockwell compared, on the one hand, multi-level propaganda, which the Jews use, appealing to all classes and all levels of society, to the very narrow propaganda of the John Birch Society, which Rockwell thought was aimed at the upper middle class and really represented specifically upper middle class interests as well. Did not have broad appeal, this John Birch Society propaganda. He also thought that the John Birch Society's propaganda was boring. While Rockwell declares the purpose of conducting multi-level propaganda, such as the Jews conduct with their mass media, he concludes that lowbrow propaganda is where it's really at, based on the fact that lowbrow population is the largest. Most people are lowbrow. Appealing to large numbers is important because of Rockwell's declared intention of being elected president of the United States in 1972, which he was still declaring in 1966. Rockwell also admits, however, that if the intellectual class realizes that something is seriously wrong, the broad masses of the people would eventually find out. In other words, there is, within Rockwell's own essay on propaganda, an intimation of the fact that if you could persuade just the thinking class of people, that there could be a key to changing the whole society. He actually implies that. Doesn't run with that implication, though. Rockwell states in regard to the interview that he had given to Playboy magazine that year that it had been necessary for him in the interview to come across as half crazy. Otherwise, Playboy would never have printed it. And this fact that he had to come across as half crazy in order for the interview to be printed at all shows a fundamental flaw in his whole approach of relying on the existing Jew-dominated mass media to get out his message. His message ends up being distorted or presented in an embarrassing manner. And Rockwell, of course, was trying an alternative to what conservatives had been doing to reach the public, which was to put out their message gutted to such a degree that the Jews wouldn't object to it. And some people are trying that again today. They seem to think it's a new idea. It is obvious that Rockwell was premature in hoping to have electoral victories in 1972, at least for the presidential election. This goal and this timetable, however, dictated that he must try to appeal to the broad masses. A more realistic plan would have placed the goal of electoral victory maybe a decade later. And in the short term, he would have focused more on winning over more capable people who would be an asset to his movement and to create white media. Rockwell's haste was undoubtedly influenced by the speed with which Adolf Hitler rose to power in Germany, only 14 years after joining the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Well, what was it that made Rockwell's plan unrealistic? What are the differences between what Rockwell was trying to do and what Hitler was trying to do? Hitler's rapid rise would have been much more difficult in the United States because the winner-take-all electoral system in the United States pretty much dictates that there will be only two major parties that will not be too far apart politically. You can read that in Jacques Ellul's book, Propaganda. The United States electoral system makes the launching of a new political party practically impossible compared to the system of proportional representation that's used in Germany and some other European countries. Germany in the 1930s was not as much under Jewish control as the United States, even at the same time. Mass media in Germany were not under Jewish control to the extent that they are in the United States. And the sense of nationalism, the will to resist, was stronger in Germany. There were wealthy German nationalists who eventually put their support behind Hitler because the country was in danger of going communist. And from their perspective, Hitler was clearly preferable to the communists. One of those wealthy German nationalists was Alfred Hugenberg, who had a media empire, a sort of Rupert Murdoch of Germany, although without the Zionist connection. And Hugenberg's media empire was crucial in bringing Hitler to power. Another factor that worked in Hitler's favor but against Rockwell is that in Germany, the aggrieved faction that threatened the nation consisted of white workers, so that National Socialism was a reasonable response. It addressed the needs of that aggrieved faction. Whereas in the United States, the main concern in the 1960s was looting and rioting Negroes. The same kinds of wealthy cowards who would finally support Hitler's movement as a way to avoid the risk of losing everything would, in the United States, instead, acquiesce in the enactment of programs and laws designed specifically to placate blacks. Squeaky wheel gets the oil. Guess who was squeaking? Blacks. Viewed in terms of Marxist dialectic, Hitler was closer to the dialectical synthesis of the prevailing forces in 1930s Germany than Rockwell was to the trends of 1960s America. Furthermore, Hitler's politics really represented the synthesis of a number of long-standing trends in German politics that had begun in the 19th century with Bismarck. Hitler really did not represent a radical change of direction, as Allied war propaganda has led Americans to believe. Rockwell's policy of strict legality, was related to his idea of the best way to make propaganda. And when I say strict legality, I mean when he had his stormtroopers out guarding his public speeches, they were very, very limited in what they could do even to defend themselves. They had to bend over backwards so as not to appear to be starting anything. At one point, he even told his stormtroopers to turn their backs on Jews that were trying to provoke them. And they were so disciplined that they did it. At least under those circumstances, some of the men that he took out with him showed discipline. Occasionally, he had some that would violate an order, and then everybody would get in trouble. Rockwell's policy of strict legality was related to his idea of the best way to make propaganda. The premise was that the vast majority of people were sincere but misinformed. Such people, sincere but misinformed, could be persuaded by disabusing them of the false impressions that Jewish mass media had inflicted on them. And as an illustration of how Rockwell practiced his strict legality and his faith in the assumption that the truth would prevail and how it worked in his favor, the best and most inspiring example I find is when there was an attempt made to have him locked up as a lunatic and how he handled that. I'm reading now from This Time the World. "Now I stood in court, charged with disorderly conduct and prepared with plenty of evidence to show who promoted the disorder and certain of acquittal. But before I could begin my defense, I got one of the heaviest shocks of my life. Although, as our friends will know, I had been expecting what happened. But I was so wrapped up in righteous indignation at the charges and my facts and arguments that it very nearly caused me to lose my composure when the prosecutor stepped up and said, 'Your Honor, I believe I have a prima facie showing here that this defendant may not be of sound mind and may not be competent to stand trial. Under the federal rules of criminal procedure and the district code, I move that he be committed to the psychiatric ward of the D.C. hospital for a period of 30 days for observation.'" The murmur of joy from the horde of Jews and the ADL who had filled up the courtroom was audible. I realized immediately that with no knowledge of the rules in insanity proceedings — see, Rockwell was often acting as his own lawyer, usually, because he said law was mostly common sense and logic, and he was a quick study. "With no knowledge of the rules in insanity proceedings, I would never stand a chance against whatever devilish plans the ADL had cooked up with the prosecutor. In addition, I had had no opportunity to prepare any defense whatever, so I asked the court for a lawyer and a continuance to get my balance and prepare a fight. Since it was clearly my privilege to have an attorney in such serious proceedings, the court granted my request and gave me a man who was an experienced police court lawyer, but who naturally had little knowledge of the kind of political battle involved and little imagination. Most of his practice consisted of drunk, disorderly, and petty police court cases, but he was honest and turned to with a will to help all he could. We got a 3-week continuance and permission to hire our own psychiatrists to establish my sanity and competence. Then we tried to find 2 Gentile psychiatrists to examine me and learned once again why the white man is being driven out of existence. Because of greed or cowardice or both, not a single psychiatrist in the area would examine me and testify. Finally, I found one Irishman who would examine me and who gave a letter as to my sanity. But that was not acceptable in court, of course. Nevertheless, it was the best we could get, so we paid him and got the letter. Meanwhile, we were getting hundreds of telephone calls from ugly-sounding Jews threatening us with death and destruction if we reappear again. Since the police had ruled that the Jews could yell and heckle to their heart's content, and I had been attacked because we voluntarily agreed to the police request to remove our precautionary troops from the crowd where they kept things broken up, I decided to give the Jews a dose of their own medicine. I organized our rapidly growing troops into four squads in two ranks, and we practiced a new tactic out behind the headquarters on the drill field. On command, any ordered number of squads would march out and surround would-be hecklers who were working themselves up to attack, keeping their arms folded so as not to be accused of hitting anybody, and roar back at the Jews. We had already found that individual Jews were not so red-hot for combat when our men stayed out in the crowd, right where fisticuffs might result in broken Jewish noses. And I knew that the would-be meeting wreckers would not last long surrounded by my men exercising their right to heckle the hecklers. So as we began to get the usual Jewish welcome the next Sunday, I ordered out the first two squads of men. One of my men, a monstrous individual named Al Wingen, couldn't resist adding his own little fillip to my orders to keep his arms folded, and brought his folded arms up heavily under the chin of a big Jew as he came up to him. Immediately, the police arrested all of us, even the man holding the flag, and packed us all off to jail. Incidentally, for those who are not familiar with such affairs, the jail is not half bad compared to the police wagon on a hot day. Ventilation is almost nil. The wagon is, of course, black. And if you have ever gotten into your car after it has been in the hot sun, you know one half of what it is like inside that wagon. And when you are in there, an hour or so, packed in together like sardines, sweating like pigs in a dark oven, the cool jail seems like heaven itself. While we waited to get bailed out most of the day, we roared the party song, squirted water at each other, and had such a ball in jail that several slow-witted Negroes asked who we were when we told them they wanted to join and said it looked like fun. Okay, back to the insanity problem. But as a result, before we had had a chance to find a psychiatrist who would testify, I found myself once again facing Judge Nielsen. I could have forfeited $10 collateral and avoided it, but as a matter of principle, we had to establish our right to speak without being convicted for disorder each time. So I chose to face him again, come what may. And come it did. Again, the prosecutor brought up his charges of incompetence and insanity. And this time, I could not get the court to wait for my own psychiatrists. The DA presented three witnesses. One was a photographer who had been at our headquarters. He testified to the signs we have been telling about the Jews, etc. The signs we have up telling about the Jews, etc. But admitted on cross-examination, he considered me thoroughly competent. Another was a man who had joined us the year before to write a psychology paper. He acted most ashamed, as he had since learned how right we were, and did the prosecutor little good. Under cross-examination, he too admitted he believed I was sane and able to stand trial. But then the prosecutor brought out the inevitable Jew, Dr. Schultz, the head of the D.C. General Hospital, took the stand and showed dozens of photostats of cartoons I had done for the college humor magazine, Sir Brown, 20 years ago at Brown University. Since then, I had fought two wars for my country, risen from enlisted ranks to commander in the Navy, commanded three Navy squadrons, established two successful businesses, and a currently successful national magazine, U.S. Lady, and never been accused of being sick. The photostats were kindly donated to the prosecutor by the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. The inevitable Jew, Dr. Schultz, also had some of our party literature, and he testified he had read it, and it showed that I was very probably very sick, paranoid. Such hatred of nice people, meaning communist Jews, was evidence, he testified, that I was probably very dangerous. There is a good bit of grim humor in that. To traitors, I am dangerous. Under cross-examination, the great doctor admitted he had never seen me before in his life and didn't even know if the stuff given the prosecutor by the ADL was really my work. But this seemed like a nice way to put an end to the Jewish pressure and agitation, which was and is driving the public officials of D.C. to injustice and even perjury in some cases. So the judge ruled that I must be dragged off and locked up with the lunatics for a month to see if I could understand the charges against me and my and assist my lawyer in my defense. For citizens who have never experienced the more brutal side of the law, it is something of a shock to discover how quickly the decorum and genteel atmosphere of the courtroom shifts to the naked force of the prison once the judge orders a commitment. As it becomes apparent that the verdict will be guilty, three or four husky marshals slide in behind you, and at the last word, hook a hammy hand in your belt and growl, "Let's go." You are lucky to hand your papers, etc., to a friend beside you before you are shoved out the side door and behind bars in a big cage, which usually contains a herd of wretched-looking criminals, mostly black, shuffling around, vomiting and spitting on the floor, and all explaining how they were railroaded. Back into the filthy tank I went with the human scum until the patrol wagon came to trundle a load of us off to the jail and the insane ward. Those who have never ridden in a patrol wagon on a broiling summer day with a load of unwashed blacks will not be able to imagine the peculiar nature of this refined torture. Finally, however, I was taken under double guard to one of what they call the units at the D.C. General Hospital. After a check-in, which even my wedding ring, which has never been off my finger, was impounded, I was handed over to two Negroes and ordered to strip. My clothes were locked up. I was given a shower and ordered to put on a degrading set of safe pajamas, which could not be used for suicide, etc. Then I was ushered out to the corridor and greeted by what the seedy-looking herd of inmates told me was the welcoming committee. This group consisted of alcoholics and dope addicts, black and white, who had been locked up there for long enough to regain some composure, and who sought sincerely to ease the shock for the newcomers like myself. But there was no easing it for me. These people were so obviously nuts, or seedy, or horrible, that it only served to double the impression on me of being locked up in a madhouse. One had only one tooth and insisted on keeping a grisly smile on his pockmarked face. Another, a dope fiend, had runny eyes and nose and clammy wet hands, which made me cringe as we shook hands. After welcoming, I was led to my room with a seeing eye at the top and an eternal light. Everything is done by the personnel there to pretend that the place is just like home. But no amount of make-believe can hide the nuts and the locks on the doors. Every door is locked everywhere, every time you go any place. Even the door to the place where they keep your toothbrush. In all fairness, I must admit that some of the Negro guards were kind and understanding, and to these I am very grateful. I was entirely at the mercy of and in the power of Negro guards, attendants, doctors, and nurses. A white face was rare. But, as might be expected, some of the guards and attendants took extreme advantage of their monstrous power over a white man and did what they could to make life miserable. With my picture often appearing on TV, these sadists took especial delight in demonstrating their dictatorship over me. Shining their infernal lights in my eyes all night was one of their tricks, making me take a shower in the middle of the night, locking my little barred window on unbearably hot nights, and giving arbitrary orders leading to my discomfort all day were some of the other methods used by these boss Negroes. In the meantime, my brave lads were out everywhere picketing and agitating for my release, even though many of them were convinced that I was a goner and they might follow me. But they kept the light of publicity on the case which is the only thing preventing the Jews from eliminating me by open and brutal direct bribery, legal skullduggery, and even violence. He wrote this in 1960. My own thoughts were often tinged with terror as I lay in my bare cell at night. It had been so easy for Schultz and the ADL to railroad me this far. It would be even easier for them, now that I was in Schultz's own hospital, to discover that I was crazier than a bedbug and lock me up without communication for life. I was even more worried about the possibilities of frontal lobotomy, where the thinking part of the mind is neatly severed from the brain by a simple operation, or injections which would make me appear genuinely insane at any hearings. It would be so easy, it seemed. But as I thought and pondered the possibilities, I came to the conclusion, which proved to be true, that while the Jews do indeed have a conspiracy going, it is not total. They can't possibly have everybody in on it, else it would soon be no conspiracy. Everybody would know all about it. The conspirators are forced to rely on a few key Jews, a few stupid or scared Shabbos Goyim who will do what they are told for money or because of fear, a larger group of brainwashed boobs who imagine themselves progressive and enlightened because they understand the twaddle put out by the liberals as deep thought. This whole apparatus works as well as it does, mostly because of the ignorance, fear, and cowardice of those who discover the truth about it. The top Jews who operate the terror and tyranny machine can survive and manipulate us exactly as the lion tamer can manipulate a cage full of deadly lions and tigers, because the animals are too stupid and afraid of the silly crack of his whip and his chair to see the situation as it is and use the enormous power they have but are afraid to use. That I was not insane, nobody had any doubt, but proving my sanity under the circumstances was a terrifying prospect. Psychiatry, being notoriously Jewish, is so steeped in its own involuted concepts that anybody who differs in our regimented society is, by their definition, nuts. Since Negroes and Jews are obviously so lovable and valuable, failure to perceive and appreciate and worship the superior qualities of these marvels of nature is ipso facto evidence that the subject is a lunatic. And here I was, not only a man who professed a dislike of many Jews and a refusal to mix socially with Negroes, but who openly and scientifically planned to put large numbers of Jewish traitors into gas chambers and get millions of Negroes to go back to their African home. What chance had I to convince Dr. Schultz's herd of psychiatrists, whose jobs depended on the man who had already committed himself to the proposition that I was probably insane? And what of Schultz himself? The prospects were anything but bright. I am ashamed to admit that they were so bad, in fact, that two of my lads, men who had stuck with me through all sorts of fights and threats and jail cells, now decided that the fight was over and ran off. One even went as far as Oregon, imagining that the whole party would soon be in padded cells. But I was convinced that I would not only get out of that hellhole, but that history has come to the point where evil has reached its zenith, and our rise and triumph is as inevitable as the rise of the sun after the dark of the night. To make things more difficult, however, my court-appointed lawyer came to see me, and whispered that he was convinced of the most monstrous plot to railroad me for life, and that my only hope lay in refusing to talk to anybody, especially psychiatrists. Mr. Parker, the lawyer, had never heard of any of the facts of the Jewish conspiracy, but his short introduction to Jewish pressure, threats, and tactics, when he was handed my case, convinced him that I was practically a goner. When I first mentioned the way the Jews work, he scoffed, but soon got panicky when he discovered that I had put it mildly. The pressure they bring on everybody and everything to get what they want in the most brutal way is frightening the first time one is exposed to it. But I was locked up and helpless under Dr. Schultz, and my only hope lay in thinking my way out of the mess. I had already discovered in my battle to expose the Jewish traitors politically that the conspiracy is not total, that only a very few top people were in on the illegal aims and plan. And these depend on fear, stupidity, and brilliant tactics to achieve their goals in what always must appear to be legal ways. The major weapon against this hardcore of plotters is publicity, which I had already achieved with more than satisfying results. They can't slide one into a dungeon or padded cell quietly when you succeed in becoming sufficiently notorious and well-known. And the other weapon I discovered, and perfect in that mental lockup, is the technique of dividing the top plotters from their tools. Here is the secret, which is worth life itself to my fellow battlers for America and the white race, when the enemy attempts to lock you up and shut you up as a lunatic. Here's the secret. Most of the people you face will be sincere, even if misguided. The Jews cannot afford to let everybody in on what they are trying to do, and they depend on brainwashing tools to do their dirty work. The tools imagine that they are full of modern, progressive ideas, etc., and sincerely accomplish exactly what the Jews want done for their own filthy purposes. For instance, it is the Jews themselves who are, as a whole group, paranoiac. The major symptoms of paranoia are delusions of grandeur and delusions of persecution. For 4,000 years, these Jews have been ranting that they are God's chosen people, a delusion which would get a single individual committed in a minute if it were not made the fetish of a whole religion. And at the same time, we are endlessly reminded, with pitiful wails, that Jews are persecuted, that they are always innocent scapegoats, anti-Semitism is hate, etc., etc. These are clear-cut and inescapable proofs of paranoiac tendencies. Knowing this, we know that the psychiatrist, when he gets hold of you, is going to be looking for these delusions of grandeur and delusions of persecutions. He's going to be waiting like a cat at a rat's hole for you to come out with the slightest hint that you, instead of the Jews, are chosen to fulfill an historical mission such as preserving the white race and the concomitant proposition that the Jews are persecuting you for trying to expose them. It makes no difference if the white race is being driven out of existence so far as it is in the power of a group of Jews and that you must fight to defend yourself from the terroristic machinations of these chosen apostles of tolerance and brotherhood. Facts have nothing to do with the situation. Any attempt to convince the psychiatrist who is steeped in Jewish thinking will only snap the last lock on your padded cell. But at the same time, the psychiatrist, if he is not a Jew himself, is still human and subject to manipulation. Knowing the rules of his game, if you have self-control and plenty of courage, you can beat him at it and win his okay. Now he gives the rules for how to win this game. The first rule is to cooperate. Instead of obeying my lawyer, who said not to talk at all, I volunteered to be a social worker in my cell block for all the insane blacks in need of therapy. I drew pictures for them, wrote letters for them, and talked to them, although their conversation was enough to send one halfway up the wall in some cases. They are looking for antisocial behavior, any indication that you can't get along. So, repugnant as it may be friendly, popular with the coons, and make yourself liked by one and all, including the guards. Above all, don't get into a fight, no matter what the provocation from the idiots, lunatics, or guards. Any violence, and they can honestly testify that you fight, are dangerous, and must be committed. The second rule is to be honest. When they sit you down with their little pads and tests and tricks, do not be afraid. They will be looking for negative attitudes and fear itself. Take it easy and attack the tasks they give you with goodwill and a determination to accomplish them well and quickly. If they ask you what you see in their ink blots and smears, gear yourself to see positive things and pleasant things, and then tell them honestly. You will see in the blots what you are set to look for, just as a woman notices another woman's dress while a man doesn't even see it. An artist sees the painting and skill of the artist in an advertisement which a layman never notices, and an architect sees principles, details, and ideas in a building which may simply be a public comfort station to the ordinary person. Do not see blood, bodies, wreckage, etc., but set yourself to honestly see birds with handsome plumage, perhaps Japanese dancers with flowing robes, etc. If you do not thus set yourself, the gruesome atmosphere of the asylum, the guards, doctors, etc., will cause you to give dishonest reactions of doom and death, which will only drive you further into the horrors of the mental lockup. The third rule is to realize that, bad as is the Jewish conspiracy, it is not all-powerful, and it is not total. No matter how much most Jews cause us to feel like disliking all of them, there are good Jews. Honest men who hate the conspiracy which is going on as much as we do. I owe a lot to a Jewish psychiatrist from another hospital who volunteered to come over to D.C. General and examine me in spite of the pressure to rush me permanently and forever into the lunatic lockup. I trusted this man, talked freely and honestly with him, and convinced him I was on the level and as sane as he was, even though our politics were 100% opposite. It was a long chance, but it paid off. He reasoned correctly that if I really were a paranoid nut, I would be totally hostile to a Jew who looked and talked like a Jew, regardless of my objective determination that he was not part of the undeniable plot to railroad me. When this Jewy-looking Jew asked me even the most embarrassing questions, I literally shocked him by telling the truth without reservations. In spite of himself, this Jew got to like me and went out and wrote up an affidavit that I was of sound mind and capable of standing trial. He, along with another volunteer psychiatrist from St. Elizabeth's, was on hand at the habeas corpus proceedings, ready to stick out his neck for me, and which would have gotten me out if I had not gotten myself out first by winning over the staff of the hospital, particularly the psychiatrist directly in charge of my lockup or unit. Dr. Schultz was head of the whole hospital, and the man who got me locked up sight unseen by telling the court I was probably insane. Under him was a liberal lady psychiatrist who was head of psychiatry. There was no question of their position in the railroading scheme. And the Jews were sure that with the head of the hospital and the head of psychiatry determined to get me, I was a goner. But even all this power won't work if you keep your head. And remember that not too many people can be in on a plot, or it gives itself away. If you're ever seized and locked up as a nut as I was, remember that the vast majority of the people you will meet are not in on the deal, and will try honestly to do their jobs, as they do with the thousands of other inmates they see all the time. It is impossible for the schemers to take them all into their confidence and get them all to help railroad you. They depend on power and influence at the top to overwhelm all opposition. In my case, the doctor directly under the chief psychiatrist was educated almost entirely in Jewish hospitals and schools, but he was not a Jew and was, I believe, sincere. I had every opportunity to howl persecution and plot. But I didn't. My lawyer had told me to clam up, and the psychiatrist knew it, but I didn't. I was supposed to be a wild hate monger, down on the world and crazy with hate of all Jews and Negroes, but I wasn't. The Negroes liked me. The psychiatrist liked me. Even the Jew, even the Jew. The patients liked me, and I was so obviously taking the injustice of the incarceration with a goodwill and calm assurance that they could not question my sanity or personality, especially after the dose of lies they had heard from the Jews before I arrived. Rule 4, if you are locked up as a mental case for trying to expose Jewish treason, is to remember that even the plotters are not courageous enough to resort to murder or outright Soviet-style injections, etc. What they try to do is frighten and goad you into acting like a nut so they can honestly testify that you are a nut from their observations and the observations of the whole staff. If you're uncooperative, how about persecution, sulk and curse the staff? They will class you with all the real nuts they see all the time who do exactly those things. All right. And there's more about that. I'm going to, since time is running out here, I'm going to move down to my next thing. This is Rockwell talking about a public demonstration that he held, commenting on what happened. Many in the movement cannot understand how I get away with what we do unless we are spies, as they foolishly and cruelly charge. Until our arrival on the right-wing scene, it was believed that the police, the FBI, and all other authorities are against us, and that we must fight them. I have proved to my associates over and over that this is not true. To be sure, the money power is in the hands of the Jews, and so is much of our administration. Some of our officials are either Jews or openly work for Jews, but the great bulk of our law enforcement officials are white men and simply enforce the law the best they know how. If anything, most of them, being by nature men of force, tend to see things as we do and not as do the criminal blacks and Jews. Although policemen and other law enforcement officials do their duty as they see it, they have almost all been uniformly courteous and fair to me and to our open, brutally frank anti-Jewish agitation. I have found that police are as prone to follow the jungle instinct of pursuit as are any creatures. When you run, they chase you. But when you go to them first, explain your plans, your knowledge of your rights, and respectfully make clear your steely determination to exercise these rights, they respect you and often go to bat for you. When they see the outrageous pressure from the Jews to stop you illegally, unfairly, brutally, and even criminally, you don't have to give them a lecture about Jewish methods for the police to be on fire with a sense of outraged justice. This is how we have won the hearts of entire police departments. No matter what the Jews do on the upper levels, the policemen, FBI agents, and honest officials who deal with us know we break our backs bending over to be fair and square and legal, while the Jews resort to such vile and disgustingly obvious tactics to shut us up that the officials can't help but admire our calm and determined courage as we stand up to this kind of tyranny and terror day after day, week after week, year after year. And that's sort of Christ-like, isn't it? I have had high-ranking officials and judges tell me privately that our public demonstration of Jewish tyranny and the pressure they themselves have experienced from the Jews has awakened them to a situation that not all the patriotic literature in a million years could have made them see. Most of the right-wing's complaints of political persecution by Gentile officials is the result of their own mistaken strategy and tactics, sneaking around, I think he means. I survive and will continue to survive because millions of people are beginning to see with their own eyes and hear with their own ears what they will never, never read. Another reason why the paper patriots have been failing so many years with their Wake Up America campaign. But on those hot July days in 1958, I had not yet learned these tremendous truths and wasted a lot of time and effort in hiding and running. Okay, 15 minutes left. I'm going to talk about Dr. Pierce, his relationship to Rockwell. Okay. Dr. Pierce contacted Rockwell after seeing him on television. While we can admire the audacity of George Lincoln Rockwell and his men for asserting the right to hold an anti-Jewish demonstration in the world's largest Jewish city, New York City, which he did, we must remember that this kind of operation belonged to phase one of his plan. The publicity-seeking activities that Rockwell undertook in this period did not represent how he wanted the world to know him. But apart from the few people that took the trouble to learn more about him, costumed theatrics became the thing for which he was known. Phase one of Rockwell's plan for gaining political power had become a trap from which he could never entirely escape. It more or less persisted until the end of his life. It is even arguable that the kinds of people that Rockwell attracted with his outrageous antics contributed to his death. But then phase one became the pattern that most of Rockwell's successors and imitators followed. For some of them, the thrill of proving their manhood by facing and defying angry mobs, which for Rockwell was a means to the end of conveying a message, seems to be an end in itself. Not a calculated provocation for the ultimate purpose of conveying a reasoned message and ultimately attaining political power, but thrill-seeking for its own sake. Rockwell said he didn't have thrill-seekers in his group. That wasn't really true. While Rockwell may have believed from 1958 until his death that he could be elected president of the United States after engaging in such theatrics, it is impossible that anybody of any intelligence today can believe this. The most noteworthy exception among the heirs of George Lincoln Rockwell is Dr. William Pierce. I once made the mistake of saying to Dr. Pierce in his presence that he had been a member of the American Nazi Party. He said indignantly that he had never been a member of the American Nazi Party. Using the word Nazi, Dr. Pierce said, is Mickey Mouse kid stuff. Dr. Pierce stipulated that he had joined the National Socialist White People's Party. Rockwell had changed the name of the organization shortly before his death. And here's what Dr. Pierce had to say about Rockwell. This is from The Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds. Rockwell was courageous and honest, and he didn't have an ego problem, Pierce answered. So many people are terrified of taking an unpopular, public stand, but not Rockwell. He wasn't afraid to stick his neck out and get vilified and beaten up. I admired that. But he was this flamboyant showman. That was his style, and I had problems with that. The sensationalist approach, the publicity stunts and so on, it just wasn't dignified. It looked foolish. And really, what we are about is no laughing matter. If you put on a show, as he was doing, calling yourself the American Nazi Party and waving swastika banners around in front of the White House, if you come on with an incendiary approach, most level-headed people, even if they think of themselves as National Socialists, are going to be hesitant to get involved with that kind of circus. Rockwell had gathered around himself a group of people who, for the most part, were quite defective in one way or another. They were cripples. Things were in constant chaos. One damn thing after another, people were fighting with each other and organizing mutinies. People had to be gotten out of jail. I thought to myself, I couldn't put up with this. I'm never going to do anything that is dependent on defective people like this. I've got to have normal, moral, capable people around me if I'm ever going to get anything done. That was the most important lesson I learned from Rockwell. Do things in a way that will attract the kind of people you can work with. Your major project at that time with Rockwell was getting out the first edition of National Socialist World, is that right? Dr. Pierce. Yes. During the magazine's production, I was still living in Connecticut. I pasted up the pages of the magazine up there after it had been set in type by an outfit in Dallas. Then I used my annual vacation from work to go to Virginia, where Rockwell had a print shop, to oversee the actual printing. It was on a piece of land in the country about 50 miles south of Washington, given to him by a sympathizer. It had a chicken house made out of cement blocks on it, about 100 feet long and maybe 12 feet wide. It had been fixed up with running water and electricity, and they had used it as a combination barracks and print shop. They had a printing press in there and racks on the wall for ink and rollers, a darkroom, a lithographic camera, everything you needed for lithographic printing. The guy in charge of the print shop, and remember this name, was John Patler. While I was around there, I had a chance to observe Patler. His real name was Yiannaki Patsalos. He was this dark, greasy-looking little guy from New York, and he felt bad he was Greek instead of Swedish or German. It really bugged him. He tried to disguise his origin by changing his name. He had this feeling of inferiority, and he had an envy and hatred for people with light eyes, hair, and complexion. I don't know exactly where this came from. Maybe it was because he had grown up in New York, and he was from a poor immigrant family and was at the bottom of the pecking order, and at the top around where he was were the English, Irish, and Germans. Anyway, he was organizing the darker members of the party against what he called the blue-eyed devils. He was a very aggressive little turd. It was wild, surreal. Patler was sort of talented, though. Besides the printing, he was an artist. He did cartoons for Rockwell. He was smart and had a lot of willpower and drive. The other people in the print shop were real losers of one sort or another, and they did the grunt work for him. When it came time to print the magazine, I stayed down by the print shop. I ate my meals in a little kitchen in one end of the chicken coop and slept in a station wagon I had at the time. And what he says there is that Patler made it a nightmare for him to try to get this magazine printed. All right, and Patler made it very hard for him to do it because he was jealous. Patler, by the way, I did some research about him. His father was a murderer, murdered his mother, and his brother was also a murderer, murdered his girlfriend. So Patler was from a whole family of murderers, and this was a guy that Rockwell, unfortunately, had attracted into his group, had kicked him out once or twice and let him back in because he had some abilities. That's really scraping the bottom of the barrel. Okay, Dr. Pierce again. On June 6, 1966, I hauled all those magazines off in my station wagon to the post office. I said to myself, Yakta alea est, the die is cast. I have to make it work now. For me, it was like jumping into unknown waters. Would I sink or swim? I just assumed that I wouldn't be able to continue working at Pratt & Whitney once the magazine was published. So I quit my job there. I also had all these fantasies about what might happen to me when I made that first public commitment, publishing the first issue of the magazine. I thought that maybe I would become the target of black militant organizations or Jewish gangsters, that I'd get attacked or shot or something. I didn't know. But I was inspired by the example of Rockwell's courage. This is Dr. Pierce talking. And I wanted to use my own name. I didn't want to be anonymous because I wanted to be in contact with people. As it turned out, nothing really happened. My theory is that the printed word doesn't mean all that much to blacks. They will only react when you actually get right in their face and confront them. As for Jews, if they sense a threat, they'll use one of their organizations or they'll form a new one and jump on you that way. All right. And then Griffin has Dr. Pierce narrate the death of George Lincoln Rockwell, explaining what happened there. And according to Dr. Pierce, Rockwell had been ambushed in the driveway of his headquarters by somebody that was almost certainly Patler, because because the back looked like him. Rockwell saw the guy's back as he was running away. And Dr. Pierce said, you'd better be careful from now on. That son of a bitch, Patler, is crazy. And Dr. Pierce continues to narrate. Well, he wasn't careful enough, because about 2.5 months later, August 25th, 1967, Patler killed him. It was a Saturday morning, and Rockwell drove out of that same driveway to do his laundry at a laundromat at a shopping center just across the street. Patler was at the same place waiting in the bushes and saw Rockwell go into the laundromat. Patler went over there and climbed up on the roof of the place and waited for Rockwell to come out. Rockwell came out and started to get into his car, and Patler shot him through the windshield of the car from the top of the laundromat. Rockwell hadn't yet closed the door and fell out of the car dead, shot in the chest. And actually, Rockwell fell out of the passenger side door. Patler was caught within an hour and got 20 years in prison, and I think he served something like 7. And Griffin makes a note that Patler was paroled in 75, but violated his parole and ended up doing 6 more years. Dr. Pierce again. I had never had an official position in Rockwell's organization. In fact, I had never even been a member. He's talking at the time of Rockwell's death. The previous January, Rockwell had changed the name of the party to National Socialist White People's Party. I may have influenced him there. I had told him that this American Nazi Party thing was a circus, not a political party. It doesn't sound real. But even with the name change, I still didn't join. But then, after Rockwell was shot, I did join. Rockwell had responded to me and been a kind of anchor, and I had launched a magazine with his help. And I didn't feel I should walk out. Basically, my thesis about Dr. Pierce and George Lincoln Rockwell is that you can take a lot of what Rockwell says, and by analyzing it and eliminating the contradictions, you arrive at Dr. William Pierce's approach to how to accomplish change. I think Dr. Pierce learned more from Rockwell than he actually realized. You can discern from Rockwell's statements that appealing to an elite is a viable approach. And also you can learn, as Dr. Pierce says, that trying to appeal through theatrics is a dead end. All right. I hope you've enjoyed the show. I hope this was informative and people learned something from it.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.